the Forged and Unbroken podcast.
Well, let's go with your background first, man, because you had like time in your experience on the rescue side of things. It seems like you got your hands in a lot. So if you want to break it down, give us the rap sheet, the quick rap sheet on you, man. Let's hear it.
If I don't, like, my wife might be a better one to do that, but I don't know if it's going to be as endearing everything that I got my hands in, so to speak.
I get that.
No, man, I've been working for Loudon. This is year 14 going on 15. Nice. You know, so like not a new guy, but not, you know, like smack dab in the middle of my career, like not getting ready to walk out the door, but not a new guy anymore. So to speak. But, yeah, man. So like, that, and you know, I do a whole lot of rope stuff. So, like when I'm not, you know, at work doing, you know, the fire department thing, I do rope access work on the side. So the whole Sprat thing, lots of, you know, bridge inspection type of stuff. And then I also, teach for the CMC rescue school as well. So that's a pretty neat thing. Like, you know, get to travel all around, meet different people, see different places, and, do rope stuff. So
that's pretty neat. Now outside looking in, I've always been interested in that side of it, close with some guys who are deep in it. To be with the CMC rescue school, that's pretty, like my impression is pretty legit. Like they're not letting anybody in that door, right?
It's like I think the word that I would use for it is humbling, like to say the least.
Yeah.
You know, I just got back. Every year they bring us out to, Santa Barbara, which is where, you know, the CMC is, for an instructor meeting. So every year, you know, all the instructors get together. I don't remember the exact number. I want to say it's 21 or 23 instructors. Like I forget the exact number. But to sit in a room with some of those guys it's impressive, man. I mean, you know, guys who have been with CMC for 25, 30 years. I mean, hundreds of like real rescues, like real rope rescues under their belt, like just an insanely knowledgeable, you know, group of people. So like to sit at the same table as them is humbling. Like, you know, it's a huge gut check every time I'm around those people. And it's a lot of fun, man. I'm so thankful to that group for giving me, you know, the opportunity for that. So yeah, it's pretty awesome.
That's cool. And that's across many industries too, right? Like these people are not just all fire service. Like these are mountaineering guides and like everything in between, from fire service to military to outdoor, like recreation type stuff, right? It's a wide swath.
Yeah, it is, man. We've got, like just amongst the CMC instructors, like we've got, you know, a couple guys with a pretty extensive, like search and rescue kind of mountain rescue background. A couple guys who were like law enforcement search and rescue, like out, you know, there's a big deal out in California. Mm-hmm. Those guys are just doing tons of like rope related rescues every year. So yeah, it's definitely not, I mean, there's quite a few guys that are either still on the job with the fire department or, you know, retired. So like that group is definitely represented as well, but yeah, it's a pretty good mix, and it's neat because everyone kind of brings their own little, you know, aspect of the rescue world to the table. And I don't know, I think that's probably what makes the CMC school what it is.
Sure.
It's just, there's a lot of legitimate experience to kind of fall back on.
Yeah, super cool. And now kind of zeroing in, that lends itself to you being on the heavy rescue in Loudon, correct?
Yeah, I think so. Like it's the two things feed off of each other well. Like, you know, being assigned to a heavy rescue company, like helps me, I think, be a decent, I hope, instructor with CMC, and then vice versa, you know, the ability to kind of travel the country and see how, you know, people are doing rope rescue in their neck of the woods, wherever in America, is like, I've been able to bring so much back, you know, to work with that. So like, the two things have been, you know, interestingly helpful in, you know, kind of feeding off of each other, so to speak.
Sure. Is that heavy rescue for the, I'm not sure how you all are set up. Is that part of like a special operations side, or is that just a dedicated, you're the rescue squad in like the station or that portion of the county?
I would say yes to both. So like the like special operations concept for us, I wouldn't say it's necessarily quite in the infancy phase, but it's not, we're not insanely established yet. We do have a very well-established hazmat team. We've got a well-established swift water team. The technical rescue side of stuff, I would say probably within the last 10 years or so, has really kind of become more of a focus and more of a priority. And that, I think that's mainly driven by, you know, population growth, department growth. I mean, we've got, you know, an insane amount of construction at all times. I mean, there's all sorts of potential for these things to happen. So, you know, kind of coupled with the desire to be a little bit more like self-sufficient as a department, you know, we're directly next door to Fairfax County. Those guys are USA Task Force One, right? So that like any resource you could imagine is right next door to us. They're there, you know, but again, like as we're continuing to grow ourselves, like it's nice to be able to provide some of those core services for our own department. So yeah, man. And like, it, aside from that, it's pretty typical with any other, you know, rescue company. Like we've got two, full-time staff, rescue companies for the county. Obviously geographically divided up as far as responsibility goes for, you know, fires and, you know, trap assignments and that kind of thing. So yeah, everything other than the special operations bit is pretty standard.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Let's dig into some of just general demographics of Loudoun County, because, you know, we were talking, I think we share a lot of similarities to from where I'm at to where you are, and just regionally being in the Mid-Atlantic, you border Dulles Airport. You, like you said, you're next to Fairfax. You're one of the more affluent counties in the entire nation and have parts of that, right? Just like we do where I'm at in Howard, we're one of the most affluent, but then we also have Section 8 and urban development housing, major interstates. Like, kind of break that down for us of what Loudoun looks like and then the just general makeup of the fire and rescue for you all.
Yeah, totally. I think what's interesting to me about working for Loudoun is like it's probably one of the more like diverse landscapes that I could think of as far as like fire department delivery. You know, like we have, it's a little over 500 square miles. So like, it's a big landmass. and you know, like if you want to be, if you're into like kind of that rural water setting, like if that's your thing, we've got plenty of that. But like you said, like we also have quite a bit of suburban kind of bordering urban-ish, type of areas. Like the, again, you know, where I'm at, like towards that eastern part of the county bordering Fairfax, kind of the backyard of Dulles Airport. I mean, you could get plenty of that, you know, type of firefighting experience as well. So, you know, I think like right around 20 engine companies, like I should probably know the exact number off the top of my head. I don't. I think 20 engine companies with five ladder trucks. And we've got four total heavy rescues, two of which are cross-staffed with an engine company in quarters. So those are at some of our more spaced out stations towards the west end of the county. And they're, you know, they're cutting cars. Like that's mm-hmm. their bread and butter. That's kind of, their reason for existence, at the moment. And then, you know, we've got the two heavy rescues, one in Leesburg and one in Sterling, that are staffed all the time, and are, you know, doing the technical rescue thing as well.
Yeah. Very nice. And you all are also a combination department, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we, you know, we've got a pretty healthy mix of numbers with volunteers and career people. We have, yeah, like the career folks and the volunteer folks, ride together on occasion. But yeah, as far as numbers go, you know, on the career side of things, I think we're looking at just over 700 at the moment. Mm-hmm. So like pretty rapid expansion too, like, you know, ever since I can remember when I got hired, like it started growing, and I was part of the growth as well. It just hasn't stopped. And I don't know that it will in the near future, you know?
Yeah, man, we're neck and neck, just with number of stations. We're half the size. We're probably a little bit denser, but yeah, the makeup from rural to suburban to metro to commercial, industrial, like all that stuff. It's, we share so many similarities. Now what we're really going to be digging in on is 347 Silver Ridge. And that was, man, we're coming up on a year, right? It was February 16th, and the report, and kudos to any department, but especially yours, that will expose themselves to a little bit of everything. You know, you put committees together, you do a significant, incident report that was just published, and, they really try to uncover all the lessons learned with this, 'cause you all lost somebody that night, and, super fortunate that, you know, you're on here to help give us the lessons learned and just talk about your experience, because not a lot of people have the experience that you have here in the service. And when you do, I know it sets us up for success. Those lessons learned and just the ability to learn from somebody else, I know has helped me prepare better. And then when those things do happen, the shoe does drop, I've been better prepared and have been able to execute on things because I've listened to these stories and I've been able to train for some of these things. You know, we're always getting thrown curveballs. We're never really going to be able to, just talking this morning with another guy, like you can't prepare for everything. You just try to get in as many reps and sets and as various environments as you can to, prepare yourself. So when the crazy thing does happen, you at least have some exposure to it. But, I'm going to sit back and I know we're going to talk out, you're going to give us a basic rundown of the incident, like pre-arrival. And, then we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of what you and your crews did. And, so I'm going to let you take off with it. I'm sure I'll have questions throughout, but,
cool, man.
Thank you for doing this.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for allowing me to talk about it. Like, as a side note, I think one of the biggest motivators for me for, you know, wanting to have this conversation with you was, you know, when you and your guys debriefed the Woodscape Drive fire.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll talk about it after we talk, you know, maybe get into like some of the post-fire stuff a little bit after, you know, the incident stuff itself. But one of the things, you know, that immediately started coming to mind when, you know, the fire was out, so to speak, and it was time to deal with everything else was that podcast. So what was interesting was like, you know, like I've never dealt with a line of duty death before. And I don't think a lot of people have, but the podcast that you guys did, provided even the slightest roadmap of like maybe what I could expect. I'm like, you know, like those guys said this happened. And like, sure enough, almost every single thing that you guys talked about happened for us as well. So, you know, everybody always fears the unknown, right? Like what happens next? You know, how does this whole process work? So that podcast that you guys did, at least for me, was tremendously helpful because I was able to at least have some iota of like, all right, like maybe, you know, maybe this is next up and then this is probably going to happen. And I, like I said, man, sure enough, it was almost identical to the stuff that you guys talked about. So,
I appreciate that, man. That means a lot. And I kind of got that roadmap from listening to other guys and hearing from military circles. And so when, you know, we started getting together, putting some of these things out, that was kind of our goal, was to give people a roadmap because, man, there were some things we just didn't expect. Or I heard it for like, hey, this is pretty normal. So, you know, we should be fearful of this, is lean into it and experience it. So, man, I appreciate that. That means a lot that, you know, it resonated with you all.
Yeah, it definitely did, man. And then, you know, I definitely had a pretty strong desire, you know, like I commend, you know, the group of folks that wrote our report. Like, the report goes into pretty good detail about, I would say, how things happen. And I think this is any investigative report, right? Like it's not, I don't expect every investigative report to be, you know, really diving into like that human element. But I think that there's a huge intangible about like why things happened the way they did. And I think the why, like you can't really capture that in a written report, I don't think. You know, so specifically when it comes to like the rapid intervention operations that, you know, myself and my crew were part of, you know, the report, I think, it kind of went over how we did certain things, like this happened and then this happened and then this happened. But as far as like why we decided to do those things, how we arrived at those decisions, I don't know that that was necessarily captured. And I don't know that it necessarily should have been. But I think that's why things, you know, stuff like this is important. You know, because my hope is that maybe somebody somewhere is going to listen to it and say, hey, like that's a pretty good idea. Hey, I like, you know, maybe we should be focus our training on this. You know, whatever the case may be, like if there is even an ounce of, you know, possibility to do that for somebody, like I'm all in for it. So, cool. Anyways, like long story short, like thanks for having me. And
yeah,
like,
likewise.
That's why this whole thing is important to me.
Yeah. Agreed.
So, yeah, man. I mean, like I guess just to get into it, like, and again, like I could only speak for, you know, like my specific experience, like it's one of those things. And just like any significant incident, anytime that there's, you know, God forbid, a line of duty death or a serious injury, everybody's got their own story, so to speak. Everyone has that, where, you know, where I was, what I was doing, what my crew did. Everyone's got that. And I don't, all of those with this incident are just as important as the next. Like, I could only speak on mine though. So like the way it kind of transpired for us was, so like we're in quarters with a battalion chief. So like we've got an engine company, the heavy rescue, two medic units and a battalion chief. So like after dinner, like we generally just kind of go out to the front bumper, you know, kind of hang out after the day. And, you know, we were sitting on the front bumper and the battalion chief was alerted for a hazmat response. So, you know, like it's not uncommon, like pretty routine stuff. Like we run hazmat responses all the time. Standard procedure, we put command staff on it, battalion chief, safety. So like pretty normal stuff. But I don't know, like for me, like I don't know that it's necessary, but I'm a big notes guy. Like I want to know what's going on with every call that's happening. And I think part of it is just being a little bit squirrely. And like the other part of it is like, you know, being like, there's only two heavy rescues in the county. So I'm always thinking, you know, like, yeah, this was dispatched as this type of call, but are we due if it turns into another type of call, if it escalates, if it gets bigger? So I'm always curious what's going on. So I pulled up the notes, you know, on my MDC as soon as the chief left. And it was pretty unassuming, man. Like it wasn't anything, you know, that was very alarming. You know, it was something to the effect of a, you know, 500-pound propane tank leaking. They had started the hazmat response. The hazmat team was on their way. This is, you know, it's not, it wasn't exactly something that was uncommon for our department, like pretty standard hazmat call. You know, those guys aren't flaring things off every day, but like they're no strangers to flaring. Like we do it pretty often. So in my mind, like, that's what was going to go down. And I actually remember, like, I feel bad for those guys because, like, a snowstorm was coming in, you know, like a 500-pound propane tank. Like, I don't know the exact numbers there, but I know it's not a fast operation. You know, so I'm thinking, like, man, these poor guys, like, they're going to be out there in the snowstorm, like, flaring off this tank. And to be honest, like, that was it for me. Like, that was the end of my thought process. Like, pretty simple flaring operation. We got a leaking propane tank. Like, no big deal. So that was it. Like, I didn't really pay any more mind to it. I definitely didn't turn on the TAC channel. You know, like certainly when, you know, like a box alarm or something like that goes out elsewhere in the county, we're all turning the TAC channel on, right? We want to know what they have. We want to hear the on scene report. We want to know, maybe we're due, maybe we're going to end up there. I'm not turning on a 500-pound propane tank that's leaking. It's just not something that anybody's
right.
Maybe people out there that are doing it. It's not
sure.
So that was it, man. Like, I didn't think anything else of it. I kind of went back to, you know, my driver and I were just kind of hanging out on the bumper, just whatever, debriefing the day before bed and, you know, all that good stuff. And we have a, I don't know what it's called, First Do. I don't know if other people are using it. It's probably an equivalent to like an active 911. I think people are somewhat familiar with that. So like whatever, calls come in, it's a, you know, it's a mapping feature. It kind of, it's that situational awareness thing. Like it lets us know whatever, like the calls generally pop up on First Do before they're dispatched through the normal system. So a little bit of that, you know, jump, if you will. So our, you know, our First Do app alerted for a structure fire with entrapment, in Sterling. So like none of us immediately are generally looking at the specifics of the address. We're looking at like big information, like what's the town, right? So is it Ashburn? Is it Sterling? And if it says Sterling, like we're definitely due on the call. So there really wasn't much, you know, much other than like, let's go, like it's time to go kind of thing. Like let's get in the rig and, you know, whatever, like any other timer in the firehouse, right? Like box, 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 like time to go. So like I climb up in the rig, like status and route. And my driver was actually the first one, like he's looking at the First Do app himself, like as I'm finishing, you know, buttoning up, getting dressed before we take off, like he's kind of getting an idea of what the map looks like himself. And he was actually the first one to say like, hey, this is like, it's the same street they're at the gas leak. Like they're, you know, this, the address for this box alarm is the same street as the gas leak. And I'm telling you what, man, like it still didn't click in my mind that the two were related. Mm-hmm. And thinking about it afterwards, you know, I'm like, why wasn't like that the moment where I was like, oh, okay, I know exactly what happened. And I think it's because like, it's not that unheard of to go, you know, two different types of incidents in the same vicinity at the same time. Like, it's not far-fetched to think that, you know, like, I'm thinking that, all right, well, I guess we're running a box alarm on the same street that a gas leak is happening. Like,
sure.
Kind of weird, but not out of the question.
Yeah.
Like, so that's all I was thinking. Like, that I hadn't really associated, you know, any other thoughts at that point in time. So we started heading down the road, and we were assigned a different tactical channel. So that's kind of an important bit to how this whole thing kind of unfolded for us. And it's, you know, again, like, you could always refer back. Anybody can refer back to the report. It's in there. The original gas leak was assigned, you know, 6 Delta as the tactical channel. And we, when they upgraded it and put the structure fire assignment out, we were assigned 6 Hotel. So we're on a totally different tactical channel, not really having any idea what's going on the other tactical channel, the original tactical channel. So, you know, we're heading down the road. We're probably, I don't know, halfway there at this point. And I've got no there's no communication on the TAC channel that we were assigned to. I've got no notes on my MDC. Like, it's just a blank screen on my MDC and like zero things being said on the radio. Like, super weird and like, you know, not common at all. So it was actually, and this was a super heads up move. We had a battalion chief responding from Fairfax, because we're right next door. He picked up on the same thing and switched over to the dispatch channel. And, you know, I said something to the effect of like, hey, we're not hearing anything on Hotel. Like, what are we on the right channel? And that was when they were like, oh, no. You need to switch to Delta. And they associated at that point the calls together. So, yeah. So he came back on Hotel and said, hey, all units responding on Hotel, like, switch to 6 Delta. So I switched to 6 Delta. And then that's when they associated the two calls, I guess, in the communication center. And that's when all the notes started popping up on my MDC. So, you know, we're, I don't know, probably 3/4 of the way there at this point, like, probably have maybe 3 minutes left of response time. And it was like, switching from Hotel to Delta was probably one of the craziest experiences I've ever had. Like, yeah. It was out of nowhere, just absolute chaos. Like, what in the world is going on? You know, so like, trying to piece that whole thing together real time with 3 minutes, if that, left in the response, that was a challenge. Like, that was a pretty significant challenge. So, and it was, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I think when you start hearing, you know, Maydays on the radio, you start hearing people talking about, you know, people being trapped. No matter what you do, like, there's a physiological response that comes with that, right? Like, your heart rate goes through the roof, you start breathing really fast, you know, and it's kind of up to you what you do with that, I think, you know? So, like, I am definitely noticing this in myself, right? Like, yeah. I could feel myself getting elevated. I could feel my pulse going through the roof. I could feel, you know, my brain's going 1,000,000 miles a minute because, like, you know, we're coming in. There's 2 heavy rescues responding to this, us and then one from across the border in Fairfax County. you know, so here I am thinking, like, we're 1 of 2 heavy rescues. We've got firefighters trapped in a basement. Like, this is us, man. Like, this is our gig. Like, this is why we exist. Like, this is, it's time to go. But unfortunately, because we were on the different TAC channel at first, we missed all the initial Maydays.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, when the explosion occurred and the upgrade came into the structure fire assignment, you know, all the initial Maydays were being called on Delta, obviously. You know, so as far as like the who, what, where, and when, and how, we didn't have the opportunity to catch that. So, you know, at this point, all we know is that we've got 2 firefighters trapped in a basement. But as far as like who they were, what units they were from, the nature of like, are they like, just can't get out, or are they pinned, or is there like, what kind of actual entrapment are we dealing with?
Yeah. And if I may, this is a good point. We kind of glossed over it just to kind of set the stage for what you are missing. So you're responding to, a pretty typical suburban neighborhood from what it looks like, you know, single family home. And it was for a reported gas leak. It was an underground propane storage tank, correct?
That's correct.
And Yes. And I guess earlier in the day, contractor came out trying to fill it, noticed that there was a leak. I don't want to get too, deep into the details, obviously, because there's only so much you can, pull from the report. But, units got on scene. There's an odor. As they're walking up, just down the exterior of their home, their meters are alarming that they have a lower explosive limit that is rapidly climbing.
Yep.
And then you had a couple units on scene, and forgive me if I mess this up. You, was it truck 611, engine 618, engine 611, and like a battalion maybe was the initial?
So it was just the truck 611 and engine 618 initially.
Okay.
Engine 611 was the first engine that got there after the explosion had occurred.
Okay.
But yeah, everything else you said is correct. Like, that's definitely what was going on there. And there was also of pretty worthy note, like, there was a life safety hazard there too. Like, there were residents in the house that needed to be evacuated. I think, and again, I wasn't there for that pre-blast phase, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I know that was the main priority. Like, there was a life safety issue, and I know those guys were looking to address that. So
yeah, they pulled people. Oh, they escorted people out of the main level. They actually went into the basement to get somebody out of the basement.
Yeah.
Lower explosive limit's climbing, and at one point it's over range. Mm-hmm. And then before you all get there, the civilians come out, but you have people all around the perimeter and on the interior, and then the whole house lets loose.
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah. And so you miss a lot of this being on hotel or even just being on the upgrade. And now as you switch over channels, now coming back up to speed, this is what you're coming into, right? House explodes, people on the exterior, on the interior, there's fire, the house exploded, and you're switching over listening to Maydays. Like, that is a 0 to 100 in less than 60 seconds.
Yeah, like right now. And it was a hectic, just in general, just a hectic scene, man. Like, unfortunately, like, we had several other fire department folks that were like pretty severely injured. There were injured civilians. So like, it was, a significant gas leak that turned into a catastrophic explosion, which turned into Maydays and a RIT activation. And it was also an MCI all at the same time. It was like everyone had their hands full, every single person had their hands full. But that was definitely the stage that was being set for us. So yeah, switching over to Delta, and starting to hear all this traffic with such little time left to kind of react to that, formulate any sort of a plan, that was a challenge.
Yeah.
I was talking about how, that physiological response, like the pulse, the breathing, all of those things, like, I could feel that in myself. And I know that that's what was going on, like, with the rest of my crew as well, right? Because, they're hearing the same traffic I am. And now the questions are coming out, like, what'd they say? Who's trapped? Like, where are they trapped? And I'm like, I was, like, what I said to them was basically me talking myself off the ledge real quick, but also trying to, like, bring some order, like, to the whole rig. I distinctly remember, kind of taking a, big deep breath in, slow exhale. And I don't remember 100% my exact words, but it was something to the effect of, like, listen, like, this is bad. We know this is bad. This is going to be bad. Like, we just need to accept that, and we're just going to operate, right? Like, we've got two people trapped in the basement. When we get there, we're going around back, we're getting into the basement. We're just going to operate how we operate. Like, it's going to be all right, kind of thing. That was all under the guise of like, let me bring order to the crew. Like, no, that was me calming myself down. Because, I could feel myself, kind of getting to that point of like, I need to, if I allow myself to give into, I don't know if panic is the right word, right? But like the just that elevated response, like, I'm not going to be able to think clearly, and I'm not going to be able to make the decisions that have to be made. So it was just a quick, kind of woo-saw moment. Let's collect ourselves and let's do the things that we have to do.
I think that's huge, and that's massive that you had that awareness of where you were. And I think you're doing something that's mutually beneficial, because crews are going to feed off of your energy, right? It's kind of like the parent with kids. Like, you are, you see yourself kind of escalating, things are ramping up, adrenaline is doing what it's doing, affecting your bodily systems. you check in and you're like, okay, I need to bring this back down to a manageable level. And then that's also going to help the rest of the crew. So I think that's, you know, I think it's some awesome introspect right there.
Yeah. And you know, like, it took me a little bit of thinking about it afterwards. Like, why did I have that moment? And that was, that's exactly what I came up with. Like, oh, that was me, you know, figuring, sorting my own self out, but also making sure that collectively as a crew, like, we're all, you know, we're kind of bringing the temperature down a little bit as much as possible.
Yeah, great.
So yeah, man, like we got there very shortly behind the Fairfax County Heavy Rescue got there just before us. They're just slightly like geographically closer to that than we were. I think we were less than a minute behind them. You know, and the I knew where I was going. I was going to the basement, but you know, I just checked in with the command officer, like, hey, we're here too. Like, you want us in the basement? And of course, you know, he told us, like, yep, you know, go to the basement with 439, you know, and get these guys out, something to that effect. So, you know, again, like, we still had no idea what the nature of their emergency was. You know, are they pinned? Are they in a void space? Are they under, you know, heavy debris? Like, what is going to be required to get them out? Do we need specialized tools? Do we need that kind of stuff?
Yeah, when you pull up on scene, how many firefighters, when you pull up, are unaccounted for? Just reading the report, it seems like either between maydays or being unaccounted for because they're, you know, working through PAR checks, there's multiple, and there's the potential of maybe some miscommunication on a possible priority four as well. Like, could you, I mean, you're walking into this, like, break that down for us.
Yeah, so the... you know, the priority four thing was pretty well known. Like, that was, I mean, I wouldn't say well known, but, that was communicated on the radio by one of the units that were, on scene. I knew pretty solidly that there were at least two trapped in the basement. Okay. As far as like, you know, who else, you know, potentially was unaccounted for at that point, I wasn't entirely sure just because, you know, like you're so lost in the fog of everything, like this chaos that's going on around you, that, you know, there might've been other people who initially, like might not have been accounted for just because everyone's kind of scattered about. But, as far as like firefighters that we knew for a fact, were trapped in the basement, like I knew that there were two. Okay. Now I didn't know what companies they were from. I didn't know who they were. Again, unfortunately we missed all of that. But I knew that there were two guys trapped in the basement.
Okay.
Yeah, getting there was my number one priority. How we were going to get there was like kind of yet to be determined. you know, I had, when we first got there, it was kind of like a split second game time decision to make. What tools do we bring, right? Like, do we take the time to strip the rig and bring kind of like our normal RIT complement, our RIT pack, saws, search rope, all these kinds of things, bring the Stokes basket, or do we stay light and fast and nimble and agile and just get somewhere quick and figure out what's going on? And I elected for the, I didn't feel like it was worth spending the time at that point to open compartments, gather everything up and bring these tools that I don't even know if we're going to need them yet or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of was like a, again, just like kind of a split second thought process. You know, I told the crew, like, just bring hand tools, like bring your hand tools. And I just want to be kind of like operating in almost like a recon mentality. Like, let's just get in there as fast as we can. Let's try to get our, you know, our hands around what's going on, how many people exactly we have trapped. And more importantly, what's the nature of them being trapped. And then at that point, there are plenty of people here. We can call for saws. We can call for a RIT pack. Like, all these things are close enough. They're accessible enough. That I just didn't want to spend the time gathering that right away. I just wanted to go. So that's what we did. Like, we, hand tools only. Yeah. And we were kind of operating in that, you know, recon type of mentality. You know, the other rescue squad from Fairfax County, you know, I think they were doing a lot of similar stuff, but they also started gathering some additional tools as well. So, between the two of us, I think it was kind of a decent mix of, being light and fast, and also making sure that people are coming behind with tools that we could end up needing. So yeah, that worked out decently. You know, like kind of running up, from the, the front of the house, like it was, I mean, there was just debris absolutely everywhere you can imagine. You know, I remember running up and there's, you know, other fire department people who are getting medical treatment. There's civilians that are getting medical treatment. I mean, people are everywhere.
Yeah.
There's pieces of the house everywhere. And the front of the house was just like a wall of fire. So, you know, I'm thinking about like, my priority is like, we have to get in the basement. Like that is where we need to be. And the alpha side of the house at that point was like, not really going to work out. And that's, you know, that's after, Engine 11 was that first engine company that got there after the explosion. And I mean, I can't think of a more, you know, disciplined group of like competent firefighters that just like immediately prioritized, you know, the firefight, with all this other stuff going on. Like I can't say enough good things about those guys. Cause you know, like they could easily have gotten sucked into a million different avenues between people who are injured and like all these kinds of different things. But they prioritized putting water on the fire and like, awesome. Definitely saved lives because of that action.
Yeah, that's great.
It was. So, and that was like when we got there and we're seeing this wall of fire from the front, like that's even after these guys have been fighting fire for at least a couple minutes. It was obviously gas fed. There was a bunch of fire to be had still. So the front side of the house was just not an option for us. So we ran around like towards the Bravo side of the house to get around to the backside. And I don't know, you know, to this day, like I don't know exactly what my mental picture was. Like I'm thinking basement, like there's going to be a walk up or a walk out or something. Like obviously none of that existed, but for, like, and I should have been able to understand that in the moment. But I think even, I don't know, like when we got around back, just seeing what was going on, it was like a shit, man. Like there is, it's nothing. There's nothing here other than a massive pit in the ground.
Jeez.
So like my mind's eye was not expecting that. And I don't know why. Like, I could see that a massive explosion occurred here, but like I was still thinking I could get into a basement door somewhere and we're going to go around back. We're going to force the door. We're going to go find these guys. There were no doors to be forced. Like there was absolutely nothing back there. But it ended up being like a pretty fortuitous place to end up, because the second we got back there, I could hear, like the first thing that I could hear that we could hear was a pass alarm. So we could hear this pass alarm and I can make out, you know, some scotch light, like some reflective scotch light from some turnout gear down in the basement. Can't really see much. Like this place is still very actively on fire. So between that and between, you know, obviously the engine companies putting water on the fire, tons of steam, smoke, I mean, all the things that come with buildings that are on fire.
And it's cold and at night.
Yeah.
And so you have the temperature differences and just being dark outside just by the nature of the time. Yeah.
That's it, man. It was just like a ginormous, fiery smoking hole in the ground. Wow. Like from what we're looking at kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, we could hear this pass alarm. I could see scotch light, and like, obviously no one should be down in that basement. Right. So, that was my first indication that like, this is probably at least one of the two, firefighters that are trapped that, you know, we're looking for. So I remember, like I had called command and like said, I need a ladder back here, like right now. Cause it was, you know, it's a decent little ways down into the basement. And luckily, one of the Fairfax County engine companies heard me say that, and one of their guys ran out and got a ladder. I swear he got that ladder back there in 15 seconds. I don't even know. It was super fast. But in the meantime, you know, I'm calling out to this person, hey, who are you? What company are you with? Like, are you okay? That kind of thing. And just couldn't hear anything. Like it was too loud. He's exhausted at this point, like just totally gassed and spent. We just needed to get down there. We needed to assess the problem. We needed to figure out a plan. So that was it. Ladder came, around back. Like we just threw it like right to where we saw his scotch light. You know, at that point my guys were masked up and ready to go. Like everyone just kind of scurried down the ladder. You know, and, two of my guys, my driver and, one of the guys in the back, like start uncovering this guy's leg. So like, he was basically in a standing position, like his face piece was on and intact, in a standing position, but trapped in the sense that he was just stuck in a bunch of debris. like couldn't move on his own power. Like there was, I don't know, if we didn't do anything with his legs, he was never going to go anywhere. He would just have been stuck there forever kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, like to complicate matters, like obviously there was a bunch of stuff that was on fire around him, at least at one point in time. So, you know, when I kind of go back to, like that initial engine company, like getting water on the fire, like they saved that dude's life. Yeah. And you know, even still, like, unfortunately he had pretty extensive burn injuries, to his lower body, but like that immediate prioritization of fire suppression, like saved his life, hands down, no questions asked. So yeah, like, you know, got down into the basement and like, while my two guys are working on his legs, moving debris, figuring out if we need to cut anything, lift anything. Mind you, like to, I don't know, I guess kind of set the stage there, like down in the basement, zero visibility. It's like being inside of a building fire. No visibility, not much heat. There's, you know, a bunch of kind of spot fires going around, mm-hmm. Going on around us. But it wasn't like we were standing in a large volume of fire at that point. Just no visibility, super loud environment. You know, folks are obviously, people are yelling and the radio's going crazy and all that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to ascertain, who this guy is, what company he's with, to try to be able to pass that information onto command to start checking stuff off the list as far as like this company's accounted for now that this was the missing person, he's accounted for, that kind of thing. And I couldn't get great information out of him. Like, and totally understandably so, like my man, went through a pretty, significant event and was hurting pretty bad and was totally exhausted.
Yeah.
Luckily, his legs were able to be like untrapped pretty easily with not much special stuff. Like the guys were able to like move the debris, just by using brute force well enough, that his legs were, you know, kind of popped out. And we had the ladder right in front of him. So, you know, it was kind of like assist him up as much as possible. And then the folks from up top in the basement, you know, just put hands on his SCBA and just kind of ripped him up, you know, the rest of the way. Cause like he was not going much farther than where he made it. And like, again, understandably, like my man was, burned pretty significantly. Yeah. Like just needed to get out of there. Yeah.
He was able to climb up, like up the ladder under his own power though.
Yeah. I would say probably, you know, the first third, maybe halfway up the ladder. I physically placed it. I remember physically placing his hands on the rung of the ladder, one to orient him.
Yeah.
But two, like to, you know, kind of like, hey man, like you can kind of do this, sort of thing. Like, you know, we'll help you. So the guys from down below were kind of pushing. And then as soon as he was able to get up high enough that the folks from, you know, up top, you know, standing at ground level were able to put hands on him, they, you know, they ripped him up the rest of the way.
Yeah, okay.
To, you know, get him out. So, but you know, that whole time the challenge was, and there's a handful of challenges at this point already, but you know, my single biggest concern was secondary collapse, right? So
sure.
I think this was some of the benefit of, being a technical rescue company. And like, so three out of the four people on the rig that night, we were, you know, structural collapse trained. So like we have a pretty decent idea of like how buildings collapse, what happens when they do, where we can expect void spaces, depending on the type of collapse, where we should, focus like extrication efforts, depending on the type of collapse, and, not being able to see anything. I have absolutely no idea what the collapse setting looks like. You know, so my biggest fear at that point, you know, as the company officer, is one of my guys is going to step on the wrong thing and they're going to drop down a floor, or they're going to, something's going to let loose and it's going to fall on top of them. Like super real possibility. But there's no choice, right? Like there's no, that was not the time to, like, there's no debating what needs to happen. It's just, it is what it is. Like that's the necessary risk that has to be taken there. But
And I'm sorry to interrupt. I feel that's such an important point to keep in mind. In so much of this profession of ours, there are going to be times when you see all of these things that are working against you. And if sometimes you go by textbook standards, you're not operating in a safe environment, but when we rarely do, right? And so you have two roads, and it's the one of, yes, there is safety, and I'm not going to sit here and say that that's incorrect, but there's also risk aversion involved with that. And you're sitting there at the point, like, I recognize all these factors. We have a lot of training. This is a risk. But if I'm risk averse right now, we may potentially do more damage to the other Mayday firefighter that is in this space. And I just want people to lean into that really quick and do some introspection for themselves. If, God forbid, if they're ever involved in a situation like this, like, yes, there are going to be plenty of times when the deck is stacked against you, environmental, thermal, mechanical, whatever. There's a lot of things that are working against you that could present massive issues and make the situation a lot worse. But then if we are risk averse, we're going to ultimately maybe potentially kill another firefighter, another civilian, ourselves, because we didn't lean into the hard work. And, you know, yes, it's a calculated decision, but you leaned in and you continued to work. And I know you're going to set us up for this next part of still doing, you know, incredible things.
Yeah, man. And like to expand on that a little bit, like, there are certain things that make me feel pretty comfortable taking risk. And like it sounds maybe a little weird to say, but it's the training component, right? Like the guys, you know, that on my crew, like super well-trained, super disciplined. Like if there were, you know, maybe if it were maybe a different group of people, like I think the end result still would have been the same. Like we still have to go because that's what we need to do. But it would have weighed a lot more heavily on my mind. You know, like when that ladder was thrown down into the basement and it was time to get down there, I mean, not a single one of my people hesitated. And like, I'm sitting there thinking like, you know, they could step on the wrong thing and we could have a secondary collapse and this could be a really bad day, but I feel comfortable. Like I feel comfortable with, you know, these guys, and mainly because, you know, we're kind of at the point, and it takes time to build, but, kind of like that, I don't know, decentralized command sort of thing. Like I trust those guys to be able to make decisions, like tactical decisions with issues that they're facing directly in front of their face on their own.
Awesome.
Because I know like we have just trained to that level together. So like there was no, that makes me feel a lot better about taking risk.
Sure. Right?
Like
that's huge.
It makes me feel way more comfortable with the fact that like these guys are going to recognize things that need to be recognized. They're going to react appropriately to it. They're going to make, you know, these small decisions here and there that like are going to positively affect the outcome. And I'm not going to have to babysit them. So
that's amazing. That's what we should all strive for. That's huge. Yeah,
it is, man. Like I am very blessed with the people that I have, but again, like that doesn't come right away. Right.
Yeah,
like you can't be a new officer to a new shift and, you know, day one be like, hey, like total decentralized command, like make whatever decisions you want. Like it takes some time. Like there's a lot of mutual trust there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was it. Like that's where I was, you know, kind of really focusing my, risk assessment, ongoing risk assessment. Like this is a little bit of a hairy situation to be in. I don't know what this collapse looks like. I can't see anything. And it was kind of weird too, because, you know, when we're searching building fires, like there's generally some sort of way to stay oriented. We've got walls, we've got windows, we've got different, you know, flooring materials to give us cues about where we're at in the building and different types of rooms. Like that didn't exist. You know, we're standing basically in Mars and can't see anything and have no idea what's to our left, what's to our right, forward or back of us. So the orientation of like, how do we not be an issue ourselves, right? Yeah. Like how do we not crawl somewhere we're not supposed to, and now we're trapped, we're disoriented, all those things. You know, so once we got, you know, the first trapped firefighter out, we took a second to kind of regroup as a unit. We got our thermal imagers out and we just started scanning to try to get as best as good of a layout of what the collapse looked like as possible. And interestingly, like during that process, my driver was like, hey, look at this. Like I found the other guy, and right clear as day in his thermal imager, you know, there's a firefighter on his hands and knees crawling. And so, you know, we're telling at this point, I've got a division supervisor, that Fairfax County chief is my division supervisor. So we're kind of relaying that to them. And again, kind of like that fog of the craziness happening. It turns out that that was the other rescue squad that was down there with us. Those guys were searching a different part of the house. We identified that person as like, hey, you know, there's somebody else in the basement. They're clearly a firefighter. They're crawling around. Maybe they're trying to get out. It ended up being one of the Fairfax County rescue squad guys. So We were able to iron that out pretty quickly. But, you know, it was kind of one of those things too, where, you know, all these like really good people were there, that really, like, I think positively impacted, like made the whole thing turn out okay in the end. So like I talked about the Engine 11 guys, like awesome crew. And then the other component there, was that Fairfax County chief, who was running his battalion 401 that night, assumed the division on the backside of the house and was responsible for like the RIT operation. So he was my division supervisor. And this is a guy that used to be with Loudoun, has taught technical rescue stuff for Loudoun for a long time. Like, we all know him. He knows us. Like, there is a personal relationship there. And on top of that, he's, you know, he's gone on, you know, I don't know how many like FEMA USAR deployments. Like, he is a technical rescue guy. He is a collapse guy. Like, I don't know that you could ask for a better person to manage a collapse with Mayday.
Stars are aligning.
They were. And I didn't realize it at the time. I remember, you know, I don't know if he wants me to use his name or not, so I guess I won't, but I remember seeing him. And like, I remember, you know, like, man, I'm glad that guy is here. Like, this is good. So, you know, we're kind of doing this thing with our ticks. We're trying to figure out where do we go from here. And at this point, the officer of the Fairfax County Rescue Squad, found us, met up with me. And it was a quick, almost like a conversation that you would have at any sort of building collapse. It just happened to be on fire. And we still had another trapped firefighter. Like, where are you searching? Where are we searching? Which areas are we covering? So, that's kind of the quick conversation we had. Those guys were going to search like the Alpha and Bravo quadrants, and we were going to finish searching the Charlie and Delta quadrants. And that's, you know, that's how we were going to divvy things up. So the other complicating factor here was, well, two things. Number one was the amount of water being, like flowed into the house, into the basement.
Okay.
And the second one was the sheer amount of noise, right? So to talk on that for a second, like, this is where it was this really weird mixture of firefighting and like technical rescue building collapse stuff, right? Like, in a collapse situation, you know, somebody on the search team, you know, whatever, they think they hear a victim, right? And all quiet gets called. Everyone is quiet. You know, they're listening for knocking. They're listening for yelling. They're listening for any of those types of signs so we could focus our search. We're in the same situation, but we're in, you know, a building fire. We're in this massive, you know, explosion, can't see anything, all the stuff. So I'm sitting here thinking about this, and I'm like, there is no way that we are going to be able to do a good targeted search for the second trapped firefighter who maybe has a pass device going off, maybe doesn't, if I can't hear anything. Like, this is, it's just not going to, like, it's going to be effort that is, like, we're going to spend way too long. So I relayed that to, like, my division supervisor. I was like, I don't know what you need to do, but, like, it needs to be quiet. And I don't know what that guy did. He's got, like, a loud, booming voice as it is. But I mean, my man, like, to the entire fire ground, like, called for an all quiet and like a pretty, like, assertive way. And it was maybe one of the most amazing things I've seen on the fire ground ever. Like, the entire fire ground was quiet. I didn't think that, you know, such a hectic kind of scene with all these things going on. I mean, people are worked up, man. People are yelling, people are screaming, all those kinds of things. And in a second, all the noise stopped. And it was just enough, like, we heard a faint pass alarm off to, like, we were facing, at this point, like, my crew was facing towards, like, the Alpha side of the house. Like, we were probably standing in the Bravo quadrant facing towards the Alpha side of the house. Mm-hmm. And we heard a faint pass alarm coming off to, like, our left side, which would have been, like, the Charlie quadrant.
Yeah.
So, like, just that, like, hey, we need it to be quiet so we could hear something. And you know, that battalion chief demanding that all quiet was enough to, like, okay, now we're on to something. Like, we could hear a pass alarm. We need to focus our search, you know, in that Charlie quadrant kind of thing.
You've reduced your entire search profile down now to a 25% section compared to the whole footprint of the home, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. That's huge. And I'm glad you said something, 'cause I read that in the report. I was like, that is such a simple but not easy thing, and to have the awareness, and I guess, like you said, it's coming from the trench side or the collapse side. They may not have ever dawned on me to get in all quiet, and that's exactly the thing that got you to hear the pass device and reduce your entire search area down to a 25% section. That's amazing.
Exactly, man. And you know, like, again, one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation with you on the podcast, because yeah, the report mentioned that, like the report captured that data point, but it, you know, I think you have to put some words to it to kind of, to really like drive home, like how important certain things are. And then, you know, more importantly, how do we arrive at those decisions?
Yeah.
So that's it, you know, like, that was kind of a game changer as far as, you know, like you said, reducing our search profile and 100%. Being able to like do a much more targeted search. The other complicating factor was all the water. And again, mm-hmm. it's like, this was the most counterintuitive thing I think I've ever asked for at a fire before in my life. And it was a decision that I was kind of going back and forth about for a second, because I knew we still had a trapped firefighter. There are spot fires everywhere. I don't know where they're at yet. I don't know, you know, if they're in a void, or at that point we did know he was in a void. I don't know how much fire is around him, but I do know that like, we're not going to be able to effectively identify where we need to start our search. If we still can't see a single thing, like I need some of this to lift real quick. Some of the smoke, some of the steam. And then on top of that, you know, we're starting to put a lot of water in this basement. So I'm worried about, you know, are we going to flood this out? Are we going to fill the void space he's in with water?
Yeah.
You know, so again, I asked, you know, my division supervisor, like, can you get the hose lines to like shut down hose lines for a second? And it felt like the craziest thing in the world to say that. And I knew asking for that, I was like, man, like if there is a bunch of fire in the void space where this guy is at, like I could be adversely affecting him right now, but we can't get to him quickly if I don't know where to start our search. I don't know what void spaces to target. I don't know where to start removing material. And I can't make that decision if, like, literally we still couldn't see a single thing.
Yeah.
So we would just be down there with saws, just aimlessly cutting whatever, hoping that, you know, led to some sort of void space. So he got the hose lines to shut down for, I mean, it might've been 20 seconds, and it was enough because, you know, like the smoke isn't contained in walls and, you know, in four walls anymore. Like there's no roof of this place. It's a crater in the ground. So that was enough to allow all of that stuff to lift, at least temporarily. So we were able to see kind of in that Charlie quadrant where we were trying to focus our search, a massive section of roof that had collapsed. It was basically like, and there's a good picture of it in the report. Mm-hmm. It was basically like a giant wall denying access to the Charlie quadrant of the house. You know, being as that's where we heard the pass alarm, that's where I wanted to start. So we were kind of working on a multifaceted rescue plan. Like some of it was delayering, some of it was tunneling. But I wanted to work on both simultaneously.
Sure.
You know, so we had some of us that were just, hey, just start moving material. Let's just start make assembly lines, like start moving as much material as possible. And then, you know, my crew, we started working with saws to expose, you know, that giant roofing section that was denying access to the Charlie side. Or the Charlie quadrant, I should say. So, we were able to cut a hole, big enough that, you know, again, like I go back to that kind of like decentralized command thing. You know, one of my guys identified a void space, and he didn't hesitate. Like there was no, hey Lou, like, do you want me to go in there? Or like, what should I do? It was like void space, I'm in, which was tremendous. I mean, he let me know what he was doing. Like, hey, I'm, you know, I'm getting in there. But it worked out nicely because he's a little bit on the smaller side and it was a very small void. So, you know, I'm kind of like watching this whole thing transpire at this point and like trying to monitor his progress, trying to direct other people to like, hey, we need to keep, expanding our cuts. I want to make as big of a opening as possible. excuse me, with the hopes that, you know, we could just expose a huge void and hopefully that's where he is. It'll make it easier to get into. But as my guy's crawling into this void space, I'm looking at this refrigerator sitting directly on top of this void space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like he is directly underneath a refrigerator and a bunch of other, you know, stuff. And this is another one of those moments where it's like, what do you do? Right. Like, what do you do? Like we know that we still have a guy trapped. We have access to a void space. Like it's what it is, but the best that we could do was identify, you know, what the potential risk was. And like, I am watching that area like a hawk, monitoring his progress, kind of thing. So, he crawled in, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 feet. There was a decent bit of fire down there still. So like he ended up getting a hose line, knocking the fire back, which filled that whole void space, you know, with smoke and steam and whatever. So he backed out temporarily, kind of let that clear out, and then went right back in. And then when he went back in, like clearly identified a firefighter in there.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that's when he said, "Hey Lou, like, and like, I don't remember 100% his exact words. It's in the report. 'Cause you know, from when they interviewed us about it, but it was like, "Hey, like, I got a firefighter, like he's alive. I see, you know, a flashlight and a helmet. Basically like I could see him, like he's moving and he's alive." You know, so my follow-up question was like, "Can you get in there? Like, can you get all the way in there?" Knowing damn well that like, if the answer is yes, like it's going to be pretty hairy. 'Cause like at that point I'm going to lose sight of him. He's going to be operating solo, you know, out of sight sort of thing. So, he tried making it in there as much as he could. There was just debris everywhere. I mean, tiny spaces, wiring, debris, you know, roof trusses, all the things. But luckily at that point, the guy who was trapped in that void space, our second trapped firefighter, we kind of watched him start moving the other direction away from us. And so I told the guys, like, just yell as loud as you can, make noise at this point, bang on things, which, you know, whatever, like maybe not great in a collapse, but like we wanted to get his attention. So we did. And like, you know, my two guys who were like, you know, watching this from in that void space are like, "Hey, he's coming towards us now." So, you know, we were able to get him to reverse course. And then this is a story in and of itself. You know, or the lieutenant who was trapped in that void space, like the things that he did to get out of there. I mean, like that, he did some really incredible stuff.
Yeah.
All in the report. I mean, he had to cut his lapel mic. He took his SCBA off. He took his helmet off. Like it was just that small of a space.
And yeah, if I may, he was, when the collapse occurred, he was in the basement. He was not on air. So this entire time for this whole operation, he's not on air, correct?
He ended up putting
his it on after. On. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Initially was not on.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah. There's a couple of transmissions in there from him about his air status. And like, that's the other thing. I don't think, you know, obviously, unfortunately, we missed it being on a different TAC channel initially. I don't know. I hope that I never have to hear, you know, another Mayday call for real again. But if we ever find ourselves in that position, like, I don't know that anybody is capable of calling a Mayday like this guy did. I mean, like, just the most clear, concise, calm. I mean, who he was, where he was, the status of his air. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And I would encourage anybody, you know, there's a whole transcript of the audio in the report. Yeah. Like, you should, like, his role, like, there's a lot to be learned from that as well, as far as, you know, self-survival training, stress inoculation. I mean, that guy, you know, physically fit dude, like, tenured lieutenant, has been to a couple fires before. And, like, my man stayed as calm as anybody I could possibly think of. And, like, effectively, I mean, I'd like to think we helped a little bit, but like he got himself out of a pretty hairy situation. With the forethought of, you know, removing his SCBA, removing his helmet. I mean, like my man stripped down to bare bones and then like crawling through a super confined area. So,
yeah, incredible.
But yeah, that was it, man. He kind of crawling towards us. And we were able to put hands on him and yank him out of that space. And my man stood up and walked out of the basement on his own power. Like we directed him over to the ladder we had down there. And like, that was it. He was up and out of the basement.
How long,
like at that point,
I'm sorry. Do you know the timestamp? I didn't look it up. Do you know like just roughly how long he was trapped under there?
I want to say like, I reviewed all this myself and I don't remember the exact numbers now. I want to say that he was out like at like 9:07 PM, something like that. I want to say it was, I don't know, in the 40 something minute range, maybe less than
I'd say the collapse was 20-40 hours. So you're looking 30-40 minutes potentially.
Oh yeah. It was a while.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, you know, running low on air. He even like said like, hey, I have a third left. I'm just going to be calm. I'm going to relax. I'm going to control my breathing. Like he's saying all this, to command. Like it was an incredible thing to listen to. So like just the presence of mind that guy had, in the situation that he was in. I mean, it's even in the report at one point in time, he's like cupping water with his hands and trying to extinguish fire that way. It was coming for him. Like, you know, he's in a void and there's fire in these, you know, tiny little voids, and the fire was coming for him. So,
and he's cupping water and throwing it at him from what's pulled in the basement where he's trapped.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Cause like, I mean, we have plenty of hose lines operating, but it's difficult to get a hose line in a tiny void space that's closed on all sides. So Yeah, he did some incredible things that night. Like that guy really did some cool stuff.
Yeah. That's absolutely amazing, man. Just everything I'm hearing is just the discipline, the training, the human performance factors that are involved of being able to manage the adrenaline in a healthy way, being situationally aware, making decisions that are not risk averse, and getting yourself out of really bad situations that are highly evolved, highly complex, rapidly changing. Everybody from command on down to you all to the trapped firefighters are just doing everything they can in a buttoned up fashion. Just so many things to be taken from this. This is incredible.
Yeah, man. It was but I think how the whole incident transpired was rough. And like there's the report outlines it pretty clearly. Like there's some pretty lessons to be driven home there. And like we've definitely already started that. But the response to, you know, the tragedy that happened, I can't think of, I mean, it worked out well because of the people that were there. Like you said, like, I feel like, you know, the stars kind of aligned. Once we got him out, there was still a little bit of confusion as far as accountability goes, because he came out without his SCBA, and there's still a pass alarm going off. So, you know, it was easy to, and, you know, initially kind of put two and two together, like that's probably his SCBA. But we also didn't really know. So like we wanted to be completely sure before we left that basement that there were no other trapped firefighters. Because how it is, like their accountability when you've got, you know, Maydays, especially multiple Maydays, that's a tough one. And you're probably not going to like really figure that out and get a good handle on it until later in the incident. So we were kind of at that point. And it was the first time I had ever used like for real, the Scott Pack Tracker, was kind of an interesting point. Like, you know, a lot of people just kind of disregard that thing as like a not reliable tool, so to speak. But like in that case, that's what allowed us to stop operations and move on to let's go figure out how to deal with all this after the fire kind of thing. We were able to, they handed us a pack tracker. We were able to pull up, you know, it was truck 611 officer. And then that was it. We were 100% sure. Like it was good confirmation for us.
Yeah. Great.
So, you know, from there, we all kind of exited the basement and like regrouped, you know. That was, I guess, kind of the end of the rapid intervention part of things.
Yeah. So just a couple of things that I want to dig in on are the metabolic side of things. So when you are, it's late at night, it's cold, you're, just tell me about like the work capacity side of things. Because obviously, fitness and wellness is near and dear to my heart, but that's in combination with experience and expertise of your skill set and marrying those two up together. If you could just speak for you and what you're comfortable with to speak on behalf of your crew of just metabolically what you're having to overcome, because the nature of our profession is that if you don't have the expertise and if you don't have the physical prowess to be able to overcome these incidents, you could be more of a liability, or the work capacity that you have, you're doing less work in a short amount of time compared to somebody else. So if you could just speak on that really quick, because I'm sure you all are, you know, zero vis, high adrenaline, high heart rates and breathing in a demo pit, like that had to be physically taxing.
Totally, man. And it was like, you know, pretty two distinct things happening that like both are impacting us physiologically. Like one is, you know, the mental and emotional stress, right? Like we're operating at a super chaotic event. You know, unfortunately, like we're starting to hear that there's, you know, a fire department line of duty death. We've got significant fire department injuries. We are hearing Mayday transmissions on the radio. So you've got all of that affecting your body. But then you also certainly have the physical side of things, you know, getting, you know, running around all this debris, getting down into a giant debris pit, navigating all of that, you know, dealing with saws, like all of these things are, they definitely go hand in hand. Yeah. So, you know, I think for me, the way I kind of combat, or, and I think we as a crew kind of combat all of that to be able to kind of like bring ourselves as close back to center as possible, I think is that training component. Because like both mental and physical training, and a lot of times what we try to do is combine the two. So for me, it's not necessarily, you know, certainly a hard workout would do that as well. But for me, I find a lot of value in hard drills. Hard drills, hard training with a stress component there as well. So I think because that wasn't the first time that we'd been stressed, certainly it was a lot more real at that point, but it wasn't the first time that we had, you know, I mean, we're doing Mayday drills frequently where we're, you know, playing all sorts of crazy Mayday traffic. We're yelling on the radio, simulated yelling on the radio. We're playing super loud music and crawling into confined spaces with the intention that let's be comfortable operating in this environment. So when we do get to that environment for real, it kind of combats that physiological response that, you know, like if I had never been stressed before, if my guys had never been stressed before in that way, I don't know that there would be a really good way to cope with the physical stress that's coming on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the inverse of that would probably be true. Like if all you do is you're just a physical stud, like all you do for 8 hours a day at the firehouse is you work out, you're going to be in fantastic shape. And like, there's no doubt that your work capacity is going to be high. But when that mental stuff starts happening, these things start getting real, the Mayday stuff, like, are you going to be able to combat it in that way? So to find that balance there, and like, please, by no means am I, you know, like a health and wellness expert at all. but I found that that's what's worked for us, like hard training that involves stress to where we're physically stressing ourselves and we're mentally stressing ourselves, with the hope that when you're dealing with both of those things for real, mental and physical stressors, like you're able to kind of fall back on that training to bring everything down a little bit.
100%. It's called the amplifying effect, where just the emotionally induced stress is marrying up with the physically induced stress, and they basically just one up each other. So you said it really well, that you have to be proficient on both sides and both systems. You can't just be physically fit in the gym. You have to be able to mentally and physically stress yourself in gear, and you can do that through training. Like it's, you can't just be, you know, a one trick pony. It's, you got to throw everything at it. And yes, do hard drills in your gear, and you can't stay there. You can't have that necessarily be every single day.
Totally.
But those two have to marry up, and that's gonna, as you guys have experienced, it's going to set you up for success. And I know for like my crews and others that I've talked to, there's common threads here for the initial preparedness, the upfront investment that's involved with these crews, and doing really amazing things and coming out on the backside with realizing some success. And there's a common thread there where they're okay doing hard things. They've stressed themselves out. Even if it's not the same situation, they have gotten in enough sets and reps and hard environments to where they're able to adapt to those new or unforeseen environments when you know, the real thing happens. So that's awesome to hear.
Absolutely. Heck yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't just at least mention Trevor Brown, right? I mean, he is a line of duty. He died that night, and if you could just, for what we know from the report, what was his position? Where was he located? Just for the call, was he the one that was out front?
Yes. Yeah. He was, you know, on the outside of the house, as far as like where he was located. That was it, man. Like, unfortunately, super tragic. Just got caught in the explosion itself. And you know, that was unfortunately how that went down.
Just blast injury.
Yeah. So, which has been, you know, a pretty big focus, you know, for us at work as well, is being able to recognize how, you know, like from, I guess, the EMS side of things, like how blast injuries, how that happens, what happens when they do happen, different things to expect, that kind of stuff. But yeah, he was on the outside of the house.
Okay. We can, I guess, fast forward a little bit, just talking about the mental aspect of it, in that I'd imagine you're being pulled in two different directions, in that you've had a fairly successful RID operation. You've managed Maydays well. You did an incredible amount of work, and I'm sure that you can sit back and sleep well at night knowing that your training experience, expertise has paid off in a healthy way for you and the team and the department. And then it's also in conjunction with a line of duty death that, you know, obviously you weren't even there for the initial blast. So you have to live and have to hold space for these two things at once.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dynamic, because I've certainly, in talking to other people, have experienced similar things on these calls, where you have high degrees of success and then you also have to hold space for line of duty and death,
yeah,
which is a pretty incredible dynamic to hold both at the same time. So if you don't mind just, you know,
digging in on that
a little bit for you and the department, that's tough.
Yeah. I had the exact same thoughts. You almost, to an extent, you almost feel guilty for feeling, you know, some satisfaction from, like,
sure,
hey, like, we, you know, we did our jobs. I think we did them pretty well, you know, because it, you know, like you said, it was a tragedy. Like, we lost someone in the line of duty. And then on top of that, like, we had a handful of, like, fire department personnel, like, get severely injured, like, out of work for months.
Yeah.
Some still haven't returned. You know, so, yeah, I mean, you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, you're kind of being pulled in two different directions, you know, and certainly, you know, like, the priority is absolutely, you know, Trevor Brown and his family, and making sure that, you know, as a department, as a community, we're doing what's right for them. Like, that's priority number one. You know, I would say priority number two is making sure that we're taking care of the people who are injured, who survived but are pretty severely injured, like, making sure we're doing everything that's right for them. And then, but also, like you said, being able to recognize, like, there were some things that went well out of this, you know, this mess. You know, there were some successes, and being able to recognize that and feel some satisfaction there as well. Like, it's definitely conflicting emotions, for sure.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And to be perfectly real, it could have been a lot worse had you not had the crews down there that you had, with the command structure and everything. So, you know, I get it. It feels weird to celebrate certain things, but keeping it real, it's good to lean into those things, because it could have been worse. And I know it's tough. Yeah, it's tough to hold space for those two.
Yeah, it's a really good point, man. Like, by all accounts, like, that should have been way worse than it was. And I think that, you know, the initial incident, the explosion, like, that was at that point, there was nothing we could have done to change it. You know, but like I mentioned, like, the response to that, you know, it was incredible. Like, the people that we had show up that night and did the jobs that they did to, you know, try to influence a positive outcome was really incredible. So, like, I do have a lot of pride in that. And, like, you know, I was proud of the department. I was proud of, you know, my peers, my coworkers, my crew. So yeah, conflicting emotions, but definitely space for both of them, you know?
Yeah. No, that's great. As we're kind of getting on the backside of this, I know that a report came out with a lot of, like, recommendations and observations, which is great. And we can dig into those. And I'll make sure to link out to the report as well with all this. What are the, I mean, this is the most respectful way possible, neat things for me to see was the blast image of, and it brought me right back to the original safety officers. I think, you know, New England era, where they called them the corner watchers, because that was, like, the initial safety officer way back in the day in the 1800s. They'd sit on the corners because they could watch if things were bowing out or anything. But it, you know, fast forward into your all's call, when you look at the top down photo of the blast. You know, all four walls kick out. The blast radius is pretty incredible. Like, multiple homes surrounding it were completely damaged. But where the corners were, just structurally being sound and the way blasts work out, you know, the corners generally didn't have as much debris, and they were one of the safer areas to be in. And that graphic was just a incredible sign of just how construction works with the blasts. You know, I don't want to say safe spaces really, really loosely, sure. Right? Yeah, there's just a lot of neat things to come out of that. That's just certainly one of the things that stuck out with me. You know, now that we're on the back end of this, you know, those people that put the report together did a great job, and it's super cool to really uncover a lot of these things. But they're able to look at this with clear eyes, whereas initial companies don't have the hindsight bias that a lot of other people get. Just for you personally, now that the report's out, was there anything now that you're able to reflect back on like that like, oh, if I can pull one or two things from this outside of what we've already talked about, is there anything else on top of it that you're like, hey, you know, this was notable for me, this is something to dig into?
Yeah, man, I think the biggest part for me was, to elaborate on some of those points with the rapid intervention operations and, how we kind of arrived at some of the decisions we did and why. But I think there's a lot of good information in there about preparedness for gas leak emergencies, how we should be going about, you know, that kind of stuff in a safe way. There are things that were good reminders for me reading that report that, you know, I hadn't read. I mean, we've got, we call them NOVA manuals, a set of guidelines for the entire Northern Virginia region, that explain all these things. But I thought that the report did a good job kind of breaking that down with a little bit more context specific to this incident that happened. So, I would encourage anybody read the report, just in general. Like, it's good to, like, we should always be looking at significant incident reports to learn. But specifically, I think from that, you know, utility emergency gas leak response, and then hopefully some of the rapid intervention things. That's what I would probably dig into the most. At least for me, that's what stuck out the most.
Yeah, sure. Well, man, I so appreciate this. There's so many lessons to come from this, and then just creating awareness of the potential and the possibilities that come out of incidents like this. Like, you know, just last shift, I think, you know, on the ladder truck, we had a dozen runs and nine of them are gas leaks, you know? And
yeah.
I've certainly taken it for granted. There are, you know, we'll run 1,000 of them and 999 of them are low budget and nothing that crazy, but it just takes one. And we've had houses explode in our first two. Like, it happens around the nation. It's not, it's not frequent, but it's also not uncommon. And so to not take these things for granted, because it goes from 0 to 60 very quick and it becomes catastrophic so quick. So, been able to, and just talking about you and your men's experiences, man, has been incredibly valuable. And I can't thank you enough. This has been super amazing.
No, man, I've enjoyed every second of it. And like that, I think is another decent point, you know, to make that when it comes to trying to prepare for these things, like you said, like, we can't prepare for everything that we're, every single thing that we'll ever be faced with. But it was a really realistic reminder that anything could happen any tour, right? Truly, I mean, like, you hear people kind of talk about it all the time, kind of get a little bit of that complacent attitude, like, yeah, but like, how many times has that really happened? Or, you know, is that really going to happen? Like, you know, that call answered yes to all those questions, you know? And so, you know, I carry that through with everything we do with training. You know, like, if you're ever, I think, stuck on what do I train on? What's the next thing? What do we move to next? I mean, quite literally, like, just think of a problem and solve it in a drill. You know, there are so many different what ifs that could happen to us out there on the street. And like, I'm not saying everything you come up with, every drill you do needs to be some crazy far-fetched thing. Like, the basics still matter probably the most. But we do need to be using some creativity and thinking about, like, you know, what could happen out there and coming up with the solutions for that, hopefully in that training environment. Cause man, that was a really real reminder that, like, if you can dream it, it could happen. You know, like, it could definitely happen, and you never know. So
yeah,
totally.
You said that really well, man. That's a hell of a place as any to wrap this up. I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, super cool. Jason, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, man. I'm